Amen. Welcome back. We're wrapping up today our series, Injustice Is As Righteous Does, and we're going to, midway through this presentation, go through a checklist of some personal evaluation tools, the process of determining where our hearts really are, then deciding if we're willing to make a commitment, and then once we've made the commitment, following through on that commitment, and what are some of the steps that are necessary in order to have an effective follow-through. When we commit to set out to address some injustice in the world, some personal, or not personal to us, but some need in the world that is very personal to another human being, we need to know first off that we're really committed that this is God's plan and not just what I refer to as a good plan. That it's a call from God and not just a good idea that we have. We want to know because when we set out to address some of the really tough injustices in the world, it's quite a battle. And honestly, it is. It's a real spiritual battle. And it's one that we need to be committed to and sometimes committed for the long haul. So we want to know that we're following through on God's call for our life and not just a really cool and novel idea that we have in the moment. So we're going to go through that checklist. And so the reason I'm telling you that in advance is maybe before you actually begin to listen to the recording for the week, you want to pause this. Grab a pen and a piece of paper or a legal tablet so that when we get to that checklist, you're able to jot those ideas down. As you'll hear in the very beginning, when we start to do some review, it's personal reflection and personal meditation that makes everything that we learn meaningful and applicable in our own lives. So in order for these checkpoints that we're going to talk about today to be meaningful and to be relevant, you're going to have a way to capture them and then reflect on them perhaps for the next couple of weeks. So I hope this is really beneficial to you, instructive for you. Next week we'll get back to our Manly Man series, and then immediately after that we're going to start a new collection of standalone teachings. So you'll find more information on that next week. So until then, hope you're blessed by this podcast. And as always, if you find that this is helpful to you, perhaps you'd like to share this with a friend. Make it a great week, man. Em? See, we're warriors in this battle together. You're serving on one front, I'm serving on another, he's serving on another. We come together to support each other in our individual missions, and then at times we have the opportunities to support each other and to help each other on a particular mission. So he's made his mission public. My hope is that in the course of the next number of months, that maybe some of the rest of you, as we invite you to confront your world with the hope of the gospel, my hope is that maybe we're going to get some others of you up here and you'll be able to share your story and we'll be able to find out how we can support you in what you're doing, how we can pray for you in what you're doing. Right? Because that's really what we're all about. Incidentally, I love what you said, that it's not our religiosity that distinguishes us. It's actually where we interface or intersect with the culture at large. So, you've really set me up nicely. That was a good introduction to get us started. We are on our final week in the Justice and Righteousness series. We're going to do a little bit of review first. For some of you, you've been here quite a bit, and so you ask, well, why do we do the review? Well, there's three reasons why we want to do review. First off, the repetition brings things to mind. It reinforces things in our memory. There's a big difference between kind of having a sneaking feeling that God told you to do something in a certain way and having a confident assurance. Have you ever been tempted?
Sure.
Have you ever thought that probably there was a way that God called us to do things, but you weren't quite sure? I like to review things because the more we review things, the more we bring things to conscious awareness instead of some sort of subconscious gut feeling that that's probably the way God would want us to do something. Well, there's another reason that we review. Have you ever heard a truth and then you hear it again 3 years later and somehow you think about that truth differently the second time you hear it? And then another 3 years? And what's happening there? Remember what we've said this cycle is, that we start with, has the sign-up sheet been around now? So what is the distinguishing quality of a person who's really a Christ follower? It's action. And a marker that works. And we're going to talk more about action today, but action is the distinguishing quality. It's not what I say, it's what I do that is going to actually define and demonstrate what? What does action demonstrate? The first thing it demonstrates is what I believe. Because, we've said again and again, a person cannot consistently act in a way that is inconsistent with his beliefs. Sooner or later, I'm going to be able to observe you and figure out what it is that you believe by watching what you live. But what informs our beliefs? It's our understandings. Where does understanding come from? Understanding comes from the fusion of two things. It comes from knowledge, and that's part of why we come here, to learn how to spell knowledge. There we go. It's knowledge mixed with, and the knowledge you get here, but here's what depends solely on you. It's meditation. What are you thinking about during the week? Knowledge comes in two forms. It comes in the information that we get, and it comes in the experiences that we have. So when God calls people to meditate on His Word, that's knowledge, and then He calls us to meditate on that knowledge mixed with what we're observing in the world around us. Those two things combined inform our understanding. So when you come here 2 years later and you hear the same thing, you're a new person. Because hopefully in the intervening 2 years, you've learned some new things, you've meditated on those things a whole lot, and so your understandings have changed. As your understandings change, that new information now mixes with the new understanding, so that's why we review. There's another reason why we review things. This is helpful if you're a parent too. How many of you have ever gone to the grocery store? It was two items. It was a quick trip in and out. Maybe it was some laundry detergent and some toothpaste or whatever. Two items. But maybe you made the mistake of running in there for those two items. And when you go for two items, right, do you ever pick up the basket that's outside the door? Of course not, because it's only two items and you can carry two items. You already know where I'm headed with this, don't you? And then you go down the first aisle and what do you see? You see that, boy, I'm kind of hungry and that looks really good. I think I'll grab one of them. And then you get to one of those end caps, and something is on sale, right? There's nothing worse than an end cap with something that you kind of would like to have, and it's on sale. And you grab two of them because they're two for the price of one. So in short order, the two items is 15. And on the way, you pass maybe the pickles, right? And so by the time you're all done, you've got 15 items. You don't even qualify for the 10 items or less category. And you're trying to juggle them all. Have you ever seen that guy or that girl walking toward the checkout counter? Hoping above all hope that the one thing you don't drop is a glass jar of pickles. If the toilet paper falls on the floor, it's okay. You can kick it to the checkout counter, but you don't want to drop the pickles. Well, that's the way we are at the grocery store. But here's the reality. Have you ever had information overload? You loved what you heard, but you didn't know how to hold it all together. See, it would be really great if we could just tie all this stuff into a bundle of helpful, useful information that would be there when we needed to make decisions, when we needed to make life choices, when we needed to decide how we were going to respond to somebody that we see. The problem is, we remember a little of this, and then, have you ever remembered the perfect response after you had the conversation? You're driving down the road, and then you remember all this good stuff that you learned, and you knew, and you were going to be ready, but you forgot it. The reason that we review is to try to tie all this together and give you a neat bundle. So that the pickle jar is tied to the toilet paper, is tied to the toothpaste, and it's all one nice, neat bundle, and you can carry it to the checkout counter, which is your mission in life. So that's why we review. So when somebody asks you what you learned here today, you can tell them that you learned how to get the toilet paper to the checkout counter. All right, so in week one, we established this clear thing. That in God's mind, righteousness and justice are connected. That in occasion after occasion in the scripture, when God talks about righteousness, he uses the word justice in tandem with it. Now, maybe one of the things that we didn't clearly establish is, how do we define justice? What is just behavior? That was a question. Maybe I needed to put a question mark at the end of that, but that was a question. So how do we define just behavior? Or more importantly, how does God define just behavior? Anybody? All right, let's maybe make it easier. How would you define unjust behavior? What does that mean? See, that's another one of those good Christian words that we use so much that we almost need an explanation for that now.
Yeah. It's not seeking God's heart. If we're seeking God's heart, everything we're going to do is going to be just. If, I'm not saying we can, but if we can seek Him the way Jesus did.
While we're having this conversation, I'm not cutting you off. While we're having this conversation, turn over to Exodus. We'll start at the 21st chapter. Again, there obviously aren't many multitaskers here, so nobody else can have the conversation, so everybody's just going to look down and turn there. All right, once you're there, let's continue the conversation. How would you describe unjust behavior?
Well, behavior that hurts other people.
There you go. He said behavior that hurts other people. Go ahead, bring.
I was going to say, here's an example. I think it's a present day example. What's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. These people don't like the decision either way. So their reaction is, I don't like what's happening. So we're going to be violent. We're going to loot. We're going to destroy businesses because we don't like this decision. Two wrongs. The old saying doesn't make it right. That's unjust behavior. So you don't like that. So that gives you a right to be violent and ruin somebody else's property and steal from them. There's a picture of it.
And remember what we have said on a number of occasions? Typically, sin harms those around us more than it harms us when we perpetrate sin. It's not uncommon for the family of the man who's had an adulterous affair to be wounded more than the man himself. As a matter of fact, sometimes sin's effects linger in the lives of those near us for generations. So that's a perfect example of what John was saying. There's a degree of treating others unjustly, and the consequences spill over onto all kinds of other people. All right. Ron defined it as treating somebody. Can you repeat that?
Doing something that affects or hurts others.
All right. So doing something that hurts others. Now, I want to get a turn over to Exodus. I guess it would be wise if I turned over there. There are, we'll say, three chapters. This is by no means the only place where some of this law is laid out. I don't know how your chapter 21 begins, but it in mine it begins with laws about slaves. And it's how you treat those who are what we'd call human property. And that in God's mind, that if a person has served you for 6 years in the seventh year, unless he desires to remain in your possession, we'll say, in your care, that he's free to go. That would really be, in that time, when you read this, you say, well, slavery is horrible. How could that be allowed? Well, in that time, this was revolutionary to suggest that a slave would be liberated at the end of a period of time. I mean, after all, if you owned another human being, why in the world would you give up that free labor? So what God was saying is, if a person found themselves in a position of being indebted, and it was required that they go serve for a period of years to undo that indebtedness, that at the end of a certain period of time, a fixed period of time, they had to be let go. further on, chapter 22, and I would really encourage you, just for the sake of informing your understandings about justice and injustice, read these three chapters, 21 through 23. The tail end of 23 moves into different things, but read these and meditate on them. Remember what God told every leader to do? Meditate on this. Why? Because the success of a family, the success of a nation, depends on people being able to treat each other justly. Now, one of the mistakes that people tend to make, we've seen this again and again, people will say, well, you know what, there's just so much injustice, there's so much ungodliness in the world, I think it would be better for us righteous people to just go over here. And we'll just live over here. And if we, the people of God, just live in a community by ourselves, there won't be this problem with injustice. The bad people will be over there. It's hopeless trying to redeem the bad people. The bad people will be over there, and us good people will be over here. And if us good people are over here, then surely there won't be a problem with injustice. Do you see any problems with that? What's that? Yeah, that's the problem. Wherever we go, we're there. There is no us and them. We're all them. Hey, here's the proof of that. Who is God writing to or speaking to when He gives all these laws about injustice and justice? Who's He talking to? He's talking to the good people. And when He's talking to the good people and He tells them things like, and when you have quarrels among yourselves, well, should righteous people be having those kinds of quarrels? He says, and when there's a point of contention where I give Ron something and I give it into his care and I say, Ron, would you take care of this? And Ron agrees, yes, I will take care of this while you're gone. And I come back and Ron says, oh, it's stolen. I don't know what happened to it. And 3 weeks later, I see Ron driving it, right? And I say, Ron, that looks like one I used to have. And he says, no, I just bought a new one. You know, believe it or not, God actually has provisions. I mean, you didn't drive what you owned back then, but God has provisions for things exactly like that. Now, why would God have to tell the righteous people to behave righteously if we all behaved righteously? See, none of us ultimately behaves righteously, and we need guidelines. We need some informing to help us to behave that way. Well, the next point is, how does the bad ever get any better if the quote good, which isn't really very good to begin with, pulls itself off to the side? See, we have no impact on the culture at large if we isolate. And here's another thing, and you can put this to the test, you can do your own research. Any time when a group of people isolated themselves in order to preserve righteousness, you know what happens within a short period of time? They develop a whole collection of hidden sins and dysfunctions and malfunctions in their communities that almost cause them to implode. Amish communities struggle immensely a lot of times. Why? I mean, they're the people who have set themselves apart. I mean, they're the closest example, right? You can drive 50, 80 miles up the road and see them. They deal with the same issues. The most dangerous kind of injustice is the kind that we try to hide. You know, you can fix the problem that's brought into the light. You can't even fix the problem that's never revealed. Which brings us to Jesus' statement, which is another way to help us remember this. Immediately after Jesus is done teaching on the Beatitudes, he moves into these metaphors for what he hopes God's people should be, will be. He says, are. Does anybody know what those two things are that God's people are to be in the presence of the world? Salt and light. So here's how we might want to look at this. Light is visible. And so we could say, light would represent righteousness. But salt has a more tactile and tangible effect. It has a purifying effect. And so salt becomes the reestablishment of justice where it didn't exist. So what Jesus is saying in a certain sense, and this is how I'm trying to tie this together so that you remember it, is that you want the world at large to be able to see something good in you, but that's not enough. You also want the world at large to be able to feel the effects of your legitimate goodness by acting on their behalf in the community. So to be light is to be the evidence of righteousness. To be salt is to be the effect of righteousness on those areas in life where there are problems. So it's both what I say and what I do. You'll just have to keep bearing with me while the phone screen goes blank. Normally I would have notes, but I got in at about 3:30 last night, so I didn't have time to do this. All right, so the thing that we said on week one is that there are those people, and you can turn over to Isaiah, the first chapter now. There are those people in life who simply don't have a voice. Isaiah, the first chapter, and this is a verse we used in the first week of this series. First chapter, 16th verse, wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Well, what's he saying? See, if I said that to a 10-year-old, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes, what would he do? Come on, you know what he'd do. He'd go hide his evil deeds, right? He'd take that literally, right? Well, okay, you don't want me to do my bad stuff out in public. I'll go to my room and do all this bad stuff, or I'll go out to the garage. But that's not what God is saying. He says, cease to do evil. Now, unfortunately, that's where a lot of followers of Christ who are not yet mature stop. They make their life all about ceasing to do evil. But God doesn't stop there. He says, learn to do good. Seek justice. Correct oppression. Bring justice to the fatherless and plead the widow's cause. And we saw there are two types of people. We are to advocate for people with no voice. How much voice does a widow have in that time? She's a female without a male advocate. She's a female that has very little work opportunity, very little income opportunity, very little voice in the community, and in all probability, if she is taken advantage of, which she may well be, she has no one to stand up for her at the time when she's taken advantage of. Which is what makes Jesus' parable of the widow who confronts the judge again and again, that's what makes that so startling and so profound, is here is a woman who has the audacity to speak up to a male in the culture again and again. But that would not have been the case. But that's not the end of it. Who's the widow taking care of? She's taking care of the kids that she has left behind, right? So the male figure in that home is gone. There's no one to speak up for the widow, but there's also no one to speak up for the kids. What do we know about our own society and our own culture and the percentage of people that are growing up fatherless? Well, whose problem is that? And I know whose problem we think it is. Well, they should just man up and do what they're supposed to do and somebody should fix it. But the reality is, have you ever been in a situation where you were helpless, that apart from someone else's help, you would have stayed down and out? Well, and the truth is, yeah, apart from God's intervention in our lives in one way or another, most of us would be where we aren't right now. And so God becomes our example. God doesn't wait for us to get our act together and then seek to have fellowship with us. God meets us right where we are in the mess that we're in and comes to us and guides us out of the mess. And so if we want to be godly, what does that mean? It means that in our own finite, very limited way, we start to imitate our Father and be proactive in addressing the inadequacies in the world. But the cool thing about it is that when we meditate on this book of the law, what we discover is those types of situations that we should intervene in, and we also discover what the responsibility of the individual is. And the reality is, and I don't want to go political here, but the reality is that if our political leaders would meditate on this book of the law from time to time, they would be able to more correctly assess what needs they should address and what needs they should push back on the individuals who find themselves in these situations. Because another type of injustice occurs too. The scriptures talk about not showing favoritism to anyone. As a matter of fact, the scriptures go so far as to say that we might at times have the temptation to show favoritism to the poor. This is, don't do that either. Don't favor the rich person because he's rich and you might get something from him, or because he's your friend, but don't favor the poor person just because they're poor and let that be the means by which you manipulate the rich person. Don't do either. All right, I'm starting to sound like I'm preaching again. I'm sorry, I do that too much. All right. One of the other key points that we looked at was that while actions are essential, there is a component of words that are necessary. Remember, we asked the question, when I look out on the world around me, when I look out at all of the problems, at all of the injustices, I can say to myself, it's just too much, there's nothing I can do. And so what do we need? We need more allies. How do I get allies? I turn those who had been those who were perpetrating injustice into people who become champions for justice. And I do that with words, not only with actions. So there has to be a component of good teaching and good information that calls out those who had before been our enemies, who had been working against God's plan, and it invites them to be partners in what is God's plan. So we each not only have to be those who have actions, the salt, we also have to have some words. We have to know why we believe what we believe. And if that diagram were still up there, I would say that when we are amateur practitioners of this book of the law, in other words, when we're new to it, we do things because we've been told to. That's what children do, right? You tell your kids to do something, and when they say why, you give them the first answer. And when they say why to that one, you realize that it's a pointless exercise because everything from there on, they're either going to just argue with it or they wouldn't understand it anyway. Right? Well, hopefully we are not all childish, not childlike, but hopefully we are not all childish followers of Christ. That we start to see the wisdom in this book. We don't just do things because God says so. We do things because God says so and we see the wisdom in it, and we are able to apply our own discretion to implement it in the best way possible on a case-by-case basis. Does that make sense? So we need to have words. We need to have deep understandings. It is not enough to have a superficial understanding of the gospel. Consequently, we not only need to learn it, we need to meditate on it and compare it with our personal experiences. All right. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 2. We're pretty well done with review now. Now, we have read this text before, but I'd like to set us up for what we're going to look at today by reviewing it again. Chapter 2, we're at the first verse. And you were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked. Did I give everybody the chapter 2 beginning at the first verse? And you were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air. The spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived. Okay, so who's Paul talking to when he writes this? Yeah, he's talking to those who are believers, but he's describing who? He's describing everybody because he says, let's read it again. And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. So it seems as if he is drawing up an us and them comparison. There's us, the good guys, and there's those guys out there who are the bad guys. They're the wicked guys. They walk in according to the prince of the power of the air. But then what does he say? Among whom we all once lived, in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind. So in essence, what he's describing is every one of us. And he's saying, we were all once dead. What do dead people do? Look at the way he describes this. This is interesting. What do dead people do? Dead people spiritually don't just lie down. It seems dead people that are spiritually dead are actually pretty busy. What are they doing? Okay, let's read it again. Carrying out the desires of the body and the mind. That's what dead people are doing. Spiritually dead people are carrying out the desires of their dead mind and dead body. What kinds of things do you think they're doing? So when we see this, we instantly rush to think of the passions of the flesh. So what do you instantly think of?
Sex.
Of course, right? That's the first thing. Do you think that's all he's got on his mind when he's writing about this? He's talking about, have you ever wanted something and figured a way to get it, which maybe was a little bit manipulative? Am I the only one in the room who's ever done that? Okay, so there's two of us. Three of us, four. This is like an auction. Pretty soon we'll be up to five. Okay, so let's not rush to the obvious. Let's make this personal and let's make this applicable by saying, yeah, we all have passions of the old man. Remember a few years ago, the miners in Chile trapped down at the bottom of the mine? I forget how many days it was exactly. It was a long time. Now, here's the thing that I want us all to receive this morning. This is important. You were dead. And you behaved like spiritually dead people do. You had your own version, your own unique brand of what spiritually dead people behave like. You wanted certain things. Maybe the guy down the street wanted different things. But you all wanted stuff and you behaved according to the passions of your mind and your flesh. And then you were given life. Were the miners at the bottom of the well shaft alive? Well, yeah, otherwise we wouldn't be talking about them, right? Just work with me. Just nod your heads. Yes, they were. Were they experiencing true life? Not really, right? They were alive, but they were not living. When God gives us life, we're still rookies at the business of living. Because we're accustomed to living in a whole different way. We have a whole different set of interests, a whole different set of passions, and we thought that was being alive. And then God redeems us. He gives us life. But we still don't know how to live. And we start out as Christians like the miners at the bottom of the well shaft. We have life, but we're really not living. So the process of becoming a real Christ follower is the process of learning how to live. How to live fully engaged. And this is what God invites us into. The process of living alongside of Him, of partnering with Him. Turn over to Luke 16. Incidentally, I want you to store that illustration away, and I want you to use it as an evaluation for your own life. There's a difference between being given life and truly, fully living. Our mission is to learn with every progressive day more about how to live. We have life. We don't need to worry about that. You don't need to go back and revisit that. You don't need to fret over that. But many of us still have a long way to go in learning how to live. All right, so we're going to begin the beginning of the 16th chapter. We've read this before, so I'm going to just read through it quickly. We read this a couple of weeks ago. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager and brought charges against him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn an account of your management so that you can no, because you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their homes. So he's setting himself up for post-management position. That's important to understand that Jesus is addressing a crowd. It's a mixed crowd. There's those who are eager to receive his message. They're his followers or want to be his followers, are curious about whether they should be his followers. And then there is a religious contingent that seems to be quite adversarial to him. Now, when we read these things, we can start to think that Jesus is being very hostile to the leaders. But the reality is that sometimes it's the only way that he can break through to them. It would be easy in our human understanding to think that Jesus is really for the common people, but he's really against the religious people. And that's not true. Jesus is for us all. I mean, you and I are just jerks in different ways from religious people. Or if you're a religious person, I forgive you, and you're a jerk in one way, and I'm a jerk in another. But we're all jerks, and so Jesus isn't distinguishing between the religious idiots and the rest of the idiots. We're all idiots. Isn't that inspiring? I hope that's the second thing you remember. Kick the toilet paper to the cash out, to the checkout, and we're all idiots. It's probably the only two things you will remember from today, too. Yes, of course. And so this wicked manager goes through this whole series of maneuvers in order to ensure that he will have money and he will be taken care of once he's no longer manager. And the master commended the dishonest manager, this is the end of it all, for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. And then he gets down to the interpretation of this whole story. One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things, and they ridiculed him. Now, why do they ridicule him? See, because the point that he's making, they don't even quite understand. Because he's moving on to a more powerful concept. The real thing that he's talking about is their stewardship of the people. I mean, there is an element of money involved, but he's saying, you're more concerned with your wealth than you are the people. You're more concerned with stewarding your wealth than you are with stewarding these people. And what God is saying is, you've been entrusted with the stewardship of these people, but you're not leading them. You're abusing them. You're not bringing life to them. Who's going to entrust you with anything more? And then he goes on. You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Now, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But what does it mean to justify yourself? So that when I am confronted with something in my own life, I have a choice. I can either choose to change me and adapt to the righteousness, or I can find a story to tell myself that gives me the reason to believe that I am still acting righteously. So to justify yourself in your own eyes is to tell yourself the story that you want to believe about yourself so as you don't need to change yourself. Okay, just think argument between you and your wife if you're still confused. Have you ever justified yourself in your own eyes when you were having a dispute with your wife? I mean, there may be times when you're legitimately right. I'm a guy. I think I'm right most of the time. But I also know that I have justified myself in my own eyes at least once. Thank you. I was going to say maybe 100 times, but I like your version better. And then he goes on. The law and the prophets were until John. And since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached, and everyone forces his way into it. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become void. And so what he's saying is that this kingdom of grace that I'm introducing does not negate the value of the law. Was it important to meditate on the law and know how to implement it properly and righteously before? It still is. Was it important to look out on the needs around you and address those needs before? Well, it still is. Nothing has changed. Nothing about the law and the way that you are to treat people has changed. Because all this was good to begin with. And then there's this interesting little thing that he throws in here. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. And, well, Jesus, you were just talking about money? And that's a pretty hard turn. Where did that come from? Well, just suppose that you were listening and you were one of these religious leaders. And just suppose that you were telling yourself a story right then and there about how you really were just. And about how there really was a reason why you were using your wealth the way it was. You were. Just suppose you were that guy. But just suppose you were that guy and you were having an affair. Just suppose that Jesus knows something intimate about the people in this crowd. And he's calling out some people. And he's saying, okay, you've justified yourself. You've told yourself this story about yourself over here. But what about that over there? And I believe he does this, not because he's trying to condemn people. Have you ever needed to be shocked out of your sin? Have you ever been confronted in a loving manner and it didn't do any good? Have you ever been confronted in a friendly manner and it didn't do any good? There was the pastor who stood up and he delivered the nice sermon and said, can't we all just get along? And you thought, yeah, as long as I make the rules, we can all get along. And you went home and justified yourself in your own eyes. And you needed someone to confront you brutally. Did they love you when they confronted you hard? Of course they did. Because it is more loving to confront someone harshly before they go over the cliff than it is to act with too much grace apart from truth and let them go over the cliff. It's almost preferred that I almost be a bully with you to save your life than to be a pansy with you and let you self-destruct. And then we move into the story that I want to focus on. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and in fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. Now, in light of all the backdrop, and this is why we did all this backdrop, who do you suppose Jesus might be talking about? Remember what we've seen already? The Pharisees are wealthy. They love their wealth. It's important to them. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abram's side, and the rich man also died and was buried. That's an interesting contrast there. Let's just think about that for a moment. The poor man died. Is there a burial? He's so poor they don't even have any place to put his body. The rich man was buried because even in death he had the wealth to be buried properly. I want you to understand that. So what I'd like to do, the purpose to our main purpose for the morning, is a simple checklist. I hope it doesn't make us feel uncomfortable. But we're going to look at where we each stand in terms of our commitment to the process of addressing injustice in the world. The first step is awareness. Anybody remember from a couple of weeks ago when we did the the left of bang stuff? And we talked about the four levels of awareness. It went from white to yellow to orange to red. Some of you probably weren't here then. We said that a person who is in white, and this was in terms of being aware of a threat, a terrorist threat, a bomb on the ground, that this is training that people in Iraq were given. That a person who is white is simply not aware. You don't are not aware at all of anything that's going on around you, and therefore anything could be a danger to you. And we flipped that around and we said that this is also true of opportunities to serve, opportunities to be advocates, opportunities to be administrators of grace and mercy. So the person is in white, it's clueless, they don't know what's going on. Then we move to yellow. Anybody remember what yellow was? Are you cheating, Ron? But yes, yellow is that I have now become aware there is a threat. So white said was nothing. We go from white to yellow. And we know that there is a threat out there. And so I become acutely aware. But once I'm introduced to the possibility that there might be things, once I become alive in Christ and become aware of the opportunities that might be present themselves for me to be the hands and feet of Christ right here on the ground, wherever I am, let's turn back to the parable, which is why I wanted to read this and compare notes. Verse 20, at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus. That's an interesting twist of words. In other words, the guy was disabled to the point that he couldn't even walk to the gate. He was put there by somebody else. And where was he put? He wasn't put in the backyard, to use modern terminology. He wasn't put out behind the trash cans. He was put at the gate. And you do know what that means, don't you? It means that every time the rich dude left his house, he had to get around the guy. As a matter of fact, the need was really inconveniently obvious. Remember that justifying yourself in your own eyes? We'll come back to that again. So he said the yellow means that you're aware of a lot of things. Something might be a threat, you just don't know what. We went from there to orange. Anybody remember besides Ron who was looking at the notes? Somebody has to answer the questions, right? Anybody remember what orange was? You've zeroed in, have the information that there is a particular threat. And so your focus is all within this one zone. So at that moment, you're no longer as aware of what's going on out here. But it also means that you're very aware of what's happening in here. And finally, we said that red represented my inability to spell. That you are engaged in addressing the threat. That you're fully engaged there. And so we said, well, everyone needs to understand where they are in this threat level. Or opportunity level. All right, so what is your awareness? And we're going somewhere with this because I'm not calling you all to be involved in every problem. What's your interest level? The story you tell yourself about the need and about the people and the cause and yourself, and this is critical. What is the story that the rich man tells himself about the poor man who is the beggar there? What is the story that he tells himself that allows him every day to almost crawl or step over top of that guy so he can get out of his gate? What are the stories that you and I tell ourselves that allow us to move through life aware of something? You can't help but be aware of the guy who's outside your gate that you got to step over. What's the story that we tell ourselves that allows us to walk over somebody? Or do we start to tell a different story? What's the motivation that you have to do something in a certain way? And it's where you start to feel a stirring. So we move from, are you aware? to, do you have any interest? And that's a heart check issue. And that's out here. It's do you have an interest in addressing anything? You're in the yellow zone. I'm looking for an opportunity. To a motivation, do you have any desire to make a difference? What's the reason for your making a difference? And there's something that God will use, but it's not inherently godly in us. Have you ever wanted to do the right thing for the wrong reason? Have you ever wanted to do good because it would really be good for you? It would enhance your reputation. It would improve your stature in the community. It would, well, honestly, sometimes it would just numb the pain inside of you and make you feel good about yourself. Have you ever done good for somebody else more because you wanted to feel good yourself than because you really gave a rip about them? I know that's a hard question to sort out, but this is all part of this justifying stuff that we do. And we're more guilty of it than we are aware, and we're all guilty of it. And this is where we now need to get personal. Do you have a call? This is where we move from orange even into red. Do you have a call to address a specific thing? And the thing is, you can do a lot of good work on your own. The question is, can you do God's work on your own? The question isn't, can you do good work on your own? Because I think we can. Every day we read about humanitarian organizations that are doing good work. But if you believe that you have a unique purpose here on planet Earth, then you must have some God work to do here on planet Earth, not just some good work. So the difference between your own interest and a call is this your mission for your life or is this God's mission for your life? And that takes some sorting out. It's why we encourage this process of thoughtful reflection and meditation throughout the week. So not every need in life is yours to address. And as a matter of fact, I mean, isn't Vinny's mission pretty specific? It isn't, I'd like to clothe all the people in eastern Pennsylvania. It's not even, I'd like to clothe all the people in Bucks County. It's just, I'd like to make a difference in the lives of a few people who are homeless at this moment, right here in Quakertown. And it's why I knew that I was going to ask Vinny to do that, and it's why this story is so powerful. Sometimes God is asking us just to address the thing where. Where was the field of opportunity for the rich man? Right outside the gate. He had to walk over it. Remember what we said about meditating on knowledge that we have. It increases our understanding. Improved and increased understanding can give you eyes to see that there is an opportunity where before you didn't even see one. So here's another final question before we move into phase two of this. Do you want to know about the opportunities? Or would you rather be kind of like conveniently blind to them? Like, have you ever asked God, just show me what to do in the hopes that it would be something that you really wanted to do and was convenient for you? Or maybe that you wouldn't get an answer at all? Because then you could at least check that off the list and say, well, I made myself available, but you didn't give me an answer, so I couldn't do anything. Oh. What do you think? All right. And this is where we get to the personal point. See, all this first part is just awareness training. We're going to come to what I call intermission. And intermission is that point in life where you know that you know, but you have to decide if you want to act on what you know. It's the space between, I think God has called me to do this, but I'm not quite sure if I want to act on this. Maybe you're there today, I don't know. I think God has called me to this. I've sorted out all these things. It's pretty clear this is right at my gate. It's pretty clear that this is a need that no one else is addressing. Yes, I do have an interest in it, because I don't believe God calls you to be involved in things that you have absolutely no passion or interest for. As a matter of fact, I don't want to be the one served by you if you don't have any passion or interest in doing that, because you're probably not going to do it well. So somewhere there is that intersection between your interest and God's call, but it's not going to be convenient. So we'll come back to the story here. What kind of man sits at somebody's gate day after day that has to be carried there and is covered with sores? Come on, think about this. What kind of guy is he probably? He might be a leper. Do you understand? What guy in their right mind that eats sumptuously and dresses in purple wants to ruin his life? He's got it all together. He's got everything he could dream of in life. His life is sculpted exactly the way he wants it, and here comes this inconvenient opportunity to serve into his life. Do you want to mess with the thing that might contaminate your life? Are you willing to say yes to God when you really know that? See, I think we all enjoy the idea, and please hear me. This is important work. But do you know the difference between taking $20 and going to the Walmart and buying a couple of pair of jeans and investing your life in something? One's a transaction. One's a lifetime commitment. See, Vinny has perhaps made a lifetime commitment to doing something. And who knows where God will take that. What Vinny has called us to do is partner with him, but we're really just being transactional partners at this moment. That's easy. You see, for the rich man to engage with this poor guy with the sores at the level that this man needed compassion might forever change his life, and not in a good way. So I want to return to a simple thought. Jesus says, no, if you try to hang on to your life, what's going to happen? You're going to lose it. But if you give up your life, you'll probably gain it. What hope do we have as people who are alive that would permit us mentally to engage with needs that might take our life in directions that we didn't want it to go? Do you really believe the promises of God that say you'll get everything back and then some? It might not be now, but eventually you will get everything back. Or are you afraid that if you give up this one and only life to pursue God's passion rather than yours, that it's all gone and it's all lost? And I don't want to know what you think about what the Bible says. I want to know what you really believe. Remember how we started this? You can tell what a person really believes by how they live their life. If I watch the way you live, if I watch what you throw yourself into day after day after day, I can tell what you really believe. Do you really believe that you will get everything back and then some? That God will restore to you anything times a thousand that you have lost in this life because you've chosen to pursue His dreams and not yours? All right, that was a pretty long intermission, but that was intermission. That was the reflective time. So we move on to phase two. And I'm going to assume, for now, the only reason you move into phase two is if you've answered affirmatively in intermission. If you, if you've decided that, you know what, you'd rather just turn around, walk back inside the house, and pursue the... I'm sure you don't eat sumptuously, and I'm sure you don't wear purple. If you do, I don't want to know. Purple just doesn't seem to be a very cool color to wear. All right. The day that you accept God's call, you're still a long way from knowing what to do, I believe. So the next step is the understandings that you're going to have to acquire. And the reason I want to go through phase two is because you could have all the heart in the world to do good, but if you don't know how to do good, you'll sit there stuck in limbo. And this is why even after Vinny shared the vision, I wanted to kind of like recap some very specific things. Anybody remember what we're going to do for Vinny? What are we going to provide? Ron, did you take notes on this? Because apparently nobody, you didn't take notes.
Coats, hoodies, and blankets.
And what size?
Large
and extra large.
And extra large, yes, there you go. Because the day we make a commitment to do good doesn't mean we have a clue as to how to do it. And this is why sometimes we get a call in our life, we accept that call, and it can take us years before we start to produce any fruit. Don't be frustrated. If you've accepted the call and you're willingly walking within the call and pursuing what the things that I'm going to map out next, and this is not God's plan, incidentally, these are my notes, so you can do with them as you choose. But here are some of the understanding questions. How, when, where, who, and why? Whose help do you need? Why are you doing this? Why truly are you doing this? And I believe that's a real important question to answer. Have you ever done anything for any... Have you ever tackled a home improvement project that was more than just changing a light socket? Have you ever done a bathroom or a kitchen or something like that? Have you ever been midway through that? And this is the kind that just goes on. It lingers. And maybe it's one of those projects where partway through you don't quite have enough money, and so it sits there somewhat undone. All right, so just humor me for a minute. I'm sure this isn't you, but a year later, the project is still going on. And you ask yourself the question, why did I ever start this? I see two smiles and the rest are dead blank stares. So apparently, you all have not accepted the call in your own life to remodel anything big. You need to have a really good answer for why you started to do that, don't you? At very least, it has to be because my wife will not shut up until it's done. At very least, it has to be that. All right, so we need understanding. So I'm thankful for the fact that God just doesn't call us to rush out and solve the world's problems willy-nilly, helter-skelter. God calls us to seek understanding, to seek wisdom before we start to implement solutions. That's entirely appropriate. The day you see the need is not necessarily the day that you act on the need. How many days did the rich man have the opportunity to serve the poor man outside his gate? A number of them. And if the rich man really was confronting a leper, don't you suppose that he would want to think about how he could do the best good for the rich man? And after all, you have other responsibilities. And so, presumably, did the rich man in this story. It is a story. But we'll give a little bit of latitude here and we'll say the rich guy did have some other responsibilities. You have some responsibilities in your own life. And so you need some understanding, some wisdom for discerning how it is that you can be an active partner with God in setting something right and yet still maintain the responsibilities that are rightfully yours, justly yours to maintain. Here's the next question. What are the resources that I need? Where will they come from and how will I get them? So if we were going to make this a modern day parable, we'd say, well, this man might need some medical attention. This man might need a place to sleep on his own. This man might need some clothes. He might need all these things. How am I going to find them and where am I going to get them? This is why we need each other, incidentally. This is why Vinny said, I can't fill all 9 shelves myself. I got 5 of them filled or 4 of them filled, but with any luck, 3 days from now, 1 more will be empty and I'm going to need to resupply. This is why we need each other's help. That's how we started this conversation several weeks ago when we began this series. That it was my goal out of this that we become a community of people who are actively involved. We are doing personal ministry and supporting each other in that personal ministry. I'm almost done. What's the propellant you're going to finally need to get you started? And I think you know what I'm talking about. It's the, okay, I'm committed to doing this. I know what I have to do. I know about when I should begin to do it. But there's the moment where there's the moment of no return. It's the moment where I buy the thing that I will have no use for if I don't do this ministry. It's the day you buy the granite countertops, okay? That's the day of no return. Once you're committed there, once you've bought the cabinets, that's the no return day. What's the thing that is ultimately going to get you started? And I believe for most human beings, that propellant is a little bit of emotional encouragement. And this is why we need each other. Is God calling you to do something? Is God calling me to do something? This is why we need to share it with each other. Because sometimes we need each other's affirmation and encouragement. Now, the whole of the kingdom of God's work should not depend on whether I'm having a bad day and whether Vinny shows up to prop up my sagging self-esteem. Right? That's not what it should be. But you know what I'm talking about. Sometimes we need a little nudge. Think about the first time in your life that you did something new and it was big. Were you a little bit timid? Were you a little bit scared? Were you a little bit nervous about what might happen? About what your capabilities were? Aren't we glad that God promises to go with us and that if something is going to be big, we will need God's help? And that's part of that propellant. I don't know about you, but I have failed at things in my life. That's the one thing I can say with certainty. I have failed at things in my life. I have been confident of the fact that certain things were good ideas and they were going to work. I mean, I threw myself wholeheartedly at, don't laugh at me, that's happened to you too, at least once. But the propellant does more than get you started. The propellant also has to keep you going. And I use that word because what I was envisioning is one of these rockets that goes up, and there's multiple stages to these boosters, right? There's a first one that breaks free of the basic pull of gravity. But then there's another collection of boosters that gets it the rest of the way out. See, it's not enough to start a good work. Remember Jesus' story about the person who doesn't count the cost before he begins? And he doesn't end up building what he needs to build? Or he doesn't end up assessing whether he has enough armament to go into battle? We don't just need what we need to get us started. We need what we need to follow through. That's my list. I'm done. As always, I end in the most abrupt and useless way possible. I should